listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I've been away for a couple weeks. Thank you for being patient. We're back now with a new show. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. And today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Ernest Hebert, award-winning New Hampshire novelist and Dartmouth College professor of English. Ernest Hebert has written 11 novels, seven of which make up The Darby Chronicles, a series that takes place in the fictional town of Darby, New Hampshire. The series completed last year with the publication of Howard Ellman's Farewell by the University Press of New England. This is a biographical note from Ernie's website. He writes, "I have two identities as a writer. Part of me is a realist. I want my novels to be truthful to the real world as I have experienced it. But I'm also a dreamer. I believe in the life of the imagination. My interest in novel writing is the interior world of the characters. Everyone has two dramas in their lives, the drama on the outside, how we relate to our loved ones, our jobs, our friends, our enemies, and the drama on the inside, how we relate to that steamy, dreamy, ongoing nutcase story in our heads. When the story in the head comes into conflict with the story on the outside, well, that's a problem for this novelist." When I spoke with Ernie Hebert a couple of weeks ago, we discussed his first Darby novel, The Dogs of March. I actually began by reading another quote that I found on his Dartmouth College faculty page. So we'll pick it up with my reading that quote, and then you can hear the conversation we have around that.
I thought I would start by reading a quote that I found from you on the Dartmouth website about fiction. You said, "It's recycling reality. It's like a long lie you tell a psychiatrist. It's a hideout for truth. It's beauty. It's Bolticky. It's everything you can feel compressed into words. It's the music an elephant experiences in the soles of his feet that tells him there's an earthquake 1,000 miles away. It's a reason to believe in God when reason tells you there is no God, or vice versa. It's what I believe in and who I am." And I loved that, and I thought it would be a good starting place just to talk generally about fiction and what draws you to it.
Great.
So, go.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I decided to be a writer. Well, first of all, you know, I could not get into college when I first applied. I took the ACT test, which is still given, I had a 6th percentile in English, which meant that 94% of the people who took the test did better than I did, and I was told I was not college material, so I joined the Army. I didn't have the confidence to do any writing or anything. I never wrote letters. I never wrote notes. I never wrote diary entries. Never wrote a thing.
Wow.
Until I actually started college at age 23. And I went from being a non-writer to a good writer almost immediately, and I always wondered why that was. And I think it's because when I was a student at St. Joseph's School in Keene, New Hampshire, I loved to diagram sentences, and I loved grammar, even though I didn't do any writing. So I actually had the math of the language in my head, though I didn't write. So when I started to write, I was ready to do it. And so, gosh, I published the second short story I ever wrote, and started writing. And I was 24 when I decided to become a writer. It came about when I read a poem by T.S. Eliot called Preludes, and I was so moved by that poem. But I thought that if I could do what Eliot had done for me, my life would have some meaning.
Yeah, so yeah.
That was the beginning of my commitment as a writer.
It's interesting to me that you said you already had the math of the language, because I think a lot of people find themselves drawn to creativity, but they don't understand the grammar or the formulas that put it together in the right way. And in a way, you had some of that difficult stuff behind you by understanding the math of it first.
Yeah, I did it backwards.
Yeah, I kind of like that.
yeah. It's the only subject I was good at in high school was geometry, So for some reason or other, I have a knack for the geometry of language in my head. And even today, even though I've never actually studied grammar since grade school, I know direct objects and objects of the preposition and participle for, the whole thing is just there.
Yeah.
To me.
And it really is sort of mathematical, if that's what you're drawn to.
Well, it's more geometrical than mathematical, I think. You know, you see a picture in your head of what a sentence is supposed to look like.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Great. Well, you've just completed the final book in the Darby Chronicles series. And the first book was The Dogs of March, which was reissued by the publisher, University Press of New England. Is that the publisher? So they reissued all of these beautiful books in celebration of the whole series as you finished it up. So I just barely finished reading the first one, so that means I have all of the rest to look forward to, which is fun. The first one was The Dogs of March, and I thought I would start by asking you a little bit about that.
Sure.
So your main character is Howard Ellman, and he is this tender but kind of rough guy all at the same time. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about developing his character initially, and also why do we love characters who are sort of conflicted internally?
Well, I'll begin with the first part of the question, and then I'll forget the second part. You'll have to remind me. But I went to graduate school, and I came back from graduate school at Stanford to my hometown of Keene so my wife could finish her education. And I couldn't get a really good job, so I ended up running a small gas station.
Uh-huh.
And one day this guy came in the gas station, the pickup truck, and he was a big, rugged, working type guy with a kind of an intimidating glare. And that kind of vaguely registered. And at the same time, I saw that he was with a small boy who surely was his son, and there was a real tenderness in his eyes for the boy, and that image in my mind of toughness and tenderness kind of stayed with me.
Mm.
And it stayed with me for a couple of years, and then I thought, I've got to write about this guy. And of course, I didn't know anything about the real person, so I had to invent him. So I started by writing a day in his life. I didn't have a novel. All I had was this image of toughness and tenderness and working. And so I wrote this long, maybe 100 pages of longhand profile of his character. Now I got to write a book. So I needed a plot. So I took a road trip. I got in my pickup truck. Told my wife, I'm going to write a plot. And I took off from Keene, New Hampshire, and I drove all day, stayed at a campground, typed out my notes, drove again, and by the time I got to New Mexico, I had a plot. I turned around, I came home, started the book, and I've written all my books like that. I do plotting in the car. I plotted my latest book, Howard Ellman's Farewell, driving back and forth from my job at Dartmouth College in Hanover to my home in Westmoreland, New Hampshire.
Now, you must be... Have you heard about the whole Amtrak writers... I don't know what they're calling it. They're thinking of doing some sort of free train rides or discounted train rides for writers who want to work on their books on the train. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, you know, I heard about that well over a year ago. It's still hot.
I think it's, I don't know. I haven't heard anything in a while. So maybe it's dead in the water, but it sounds like it would be a good thing for you if it happens. Then you don't have to drive.
I'm going to go to New Orleans next winter, and maybe I'll take the train. But I like the car. I like talking into my iPhone for plots.
Yeah. Do you ever dictate actual narrative, or is it all just notes?
No, just notes. I think my muscle memory in my hands is smarter than my brain, so I need my hands to think.
So in The Dogs of March, the point of view shifts around. I mean, there is Howard as a main character. He's very He's very ever-present as the protagonist in this book, and yet we do sort of shift through points of view, and we know what other characters are thinking and feeling from time to time. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your take on point of view, or at least with this book.
What a great question. Yeah, for me, point of view is a kind of an entry into voice, which is the most important part of any book, is finding the voice for a book. And when I was writing Dogs of March, one thing I wanted to do is I wanted to have an antagonist in Zoe Cutter, mm-hmm. but I didn't want her to be like the bad guy. I wanted her to be a fully realized person, mm-hmm. and since I couldn't really portray her only through Howard, in order for the reader to get a sense of how what she thinks of herself, I had to shift points of view, and that's the formula I follow for that book. I find that every book is a little different. You have to sort of discover the way to write the book by actually doing it.
Right. So how much stock do you put in the rules of things, like in craft books, they'll say that you should approach point of view this way or that way? Because your book was not really omniscient, but it wasn't really, I guess it was sort of third person close, but kind of moving. So
yeah, I call it multi-character point of view.
Okay.
And to me, discovering how to write the book is the act of writing itself.
Yeah.
It's not any particular rules. But the rules I follow is I write through character. I have to know the character before I know the story. So I always begin with the character, like I said, a character portrait, no story. From there grows the story, the plot. And I get to point of view by experimenting. When I'm writing that character portrait, I'll write sometimes in first person and sometimes in third person. I'll try to write long, elegant, ornate sentences or little short sentences. And what happens is that when I'm not thinking about it and all of a sudden writing freely, that's the voice. And it sneaks up on you. It comes through this process rather than me forcing it.
Right.
Does it make sense?
Yeah, it does. I really liked Howard as a character, and now that you've mentioned how you came up with him, it makes a lot of sense to me. One aspect of his personality that you include is that it's really hard for him to keep his temper. He has a terrible, explosive temper, at least, sort of superficially to watch him. You think he's a pretty angry man, although he's also, in a lot of ways, very tender, as we said before. And we mostly empathize with him. So I wondered if you could talk about writing a character who has flaws. I don't mean he's completely flawed, but a character who has flaws, yet your reader will empathize with him.
Well, what I do is I don't know other people. I only know myself, and even myself I don't know it fully. So I use my own flaws and my own strengths. And I am occasionally a horse's ass. I will shout things out that I don't really feel or believe in, but just shout them out. And so I take my own foibles and exaggerate them. Because I know what it feels like to shoot my mouth off and say the wrong thing to hurt people. I know that feeling. So I can write about that feeling. I can't write about things I don't know about.
And, right.
And so what I do is I take my little scoot up things and just run with them.
Yeah. Okay. How did you decide to turn this into a series in the first place?
First of all, my first agent was Mavis McIntosh, who was, McIntosh and Otis, the first woman's big-time agency in New York. Mm-hmm. She was a real, very important person with John Steinbeck's agent, among other things. And she gave me some advice. She said, Ernie, don't get involved in office politics. It'll only corrupt you and you won't be able to write. And she said, whatever you do, don't write a series. They'll only read the first one. And she was... And she was right about that in both things. But I didn't follow her advice on the second part because what happened was, when I wrote The Dogs of March, I had a character, Ollie Jordan, you know, who was a guy who lives in a shack, you know.
Right.
And I didn't really know Ollie, but he got into my skin, and especially his relationship with his oldest son. And I thought, wow, I have to learn more about that. So I started to write about Ollie, and that blossomed into A Little More Than Kin. And then when I was writing Whisper My Name, which is the hardest book I had to write, because I probably shouldn't have been writing a book then, but I was doing it because, you know, it was kind of expected of me. Mm. I was jogging along the roadside one day when all of a sudden the next two books, The Passion of Estelle Jordan and Live Free or Die, just appeared in my head almost like a vision from on high. So I knew I had to have five books. And then after I wrote the fifth book, which ends in the birth of a child, it's a tragic love story, ends in the birth of a baby, I thought, well, what happened to the baby?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I have to wait 12 years to... All my books are written in real time. That is, they're written... The setting takes place in the time I'm writing them. So I had to wait 12 years to write the sixth book to find out what happened to that damn baby. And finally, I wrote the last book, you know, when he's 24.
Mm.
So anyway, my long-winded answer to your short question is that there are always unanswered questions in a novel I write, and I want to know the answers, so I keep at it.
Yeah, yeah.
And along the way, you know, I like the town of Derby because it's kind of a mix of three New Hampshire towns where I have roots. There's West Milan, where I live today. There's Sullivan, where I used to have a cabin, kind of like Cootie Patterson's cabin.
Oh, yeah.
And then my mother was a nanny for a wealthy family in Dublin, New Hampshire. And in future books after The Dogs of March, there's a lot of there's a wealthy part of Derby that makes an appearance.
Yeah.
And so that I kind of took that world that I learned about from my mother and put it into the book and created this multifaceted small New Hampshire town that I call Derby.
Now you're mentioning your mother having worked for that person. It reminded me of a quote that I found of yours somewhere. You said you have an affection for the old rich, but a bias against the new rich. I thought that was interesting. I wonder, and I think it probably comes across in your writings about Derby and class differences. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, you know, like the my mother worked for the Cabot family.
As in the cheese?
No, it was the Boston Cabots.
Okay.
You know, the Cabots speak only to the Lowells, and the Lowells speak only to God. You ever heard that line?
Okay.
My mother really liked Mrs. Cabot a lot. You know, that was her boss. And she worked. The Cabots had a house in Hanover,
okay,
and a house in Dublin. And the house in Dublin was a huge mansion that was so big that and had so many servants that there was one guy, his only job was to polish things. That's how many servants they had in that place. So I heard all these kind of upstairs, downstairs stories from my mom. And later I got to know the people who were, you know, related to the Cabots in Dublin. And I got to know a lot of rich, you know, people who were tied to rich people who was like the you know, Alexander James, who was Henry James's brother.
Yeah.
And all these rich people. And I really got to really like these people. They were sophisticated, and they were very liberal-minded people. I just loved them. And I kind of vaguely identified with them. But then I meet these kind of new rich people who are, you know, make a zillion bucks one way or the other, and they're all kind of, not all, but the ones I met were tended to be kind of crass and mean-spirited. And so I formed that bias. So another bias I had, you know, for me, I write a little bit with a chip on my shoulder. You know, that anger that Howard has, well, a lot of that's my own anger. And a lot of that anger, when I wrote The Dogs of March, came from a couple of books I read that I just hated. One was The Great Gatsby, which really demeans working people. The only character in the book who has a job is Ralph, is what's his name, Wilson, who ends up being the killer.
Is he the husband of
Myrtle's husband?
Myrtle, right? Yeah.
Myrtle's husband and Wilson. He runs a little gas station,
right?
In a repair shop, and he's portrayed as stupid,
yeah,
bone stupid, really stupid. He can't tell that his wife's having an affair. Doesn't know who's having an affair with. Then he goes out and shoots the wrong guy. And I thought the rest of these characters in this book make no sense to me. Gatsby doesn't make any sense to me, and Tom Buchanan's an asshole, and Daisy's a ditz, and Nick is a closet gay guy, and the only character that, and Myrtle's a slut. The only character in the book that makes any sense to me is Wilson, and he ends up being this killer. So I really had an animus against that book. And but the book that really teed me off was Deliverance, in which, you know, I don't know if you deal. You know the book Deliverance, the movie?
I know the movie. I must say I haven't read the book, so.
Yeah, well, the movie's a lot like the book. And in the movie, as in the book, the rural people, the rural underclass people are portrayed as not even as human. They're like devils.
Yeah,
and I thought that was totally unfair. So what I decided when I wrote The Dogs of March, I was going to create a working class person, and he was going to be the protagonist. Plus, he was going to have an interior life. Very rarely did I see writers give an interior life to working class people, and that's what I tried to make as part of my career, is I want to give working people not just a voice, but an interior life.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I wanted to read a little quick quote from the book. This is early on, and one of the people who's in charge at the company where Howard works, Mr. Lodge, he says something to Howard about the world becoming more complicated, and Howard reflects quickly on his world, and you wrote, land, house, family, car, tools, guns, garden, beer, work, the quest for the square-tail trout, neither more complicated nor less complicated, but the same. And I love that moment, because it's like in this really quick snapshot, we see Howard's take on what his world actually is. It's this list of things. And they're important to him, and they aren't more or less complicated, and Mr. Lodge has no idea what Howard's world is like at all.
That's right.
But that is an internal life. I mean, he's thinking about what's important to him right there. So I liked that part. That's the only reason I was going to mention it.
Well, you know, I started work when I was 16. I worked with my father. My father was a factory worker. Not at all like Howard, by the way. He was very shy and didn't have Howard's personality, but he was an incredibly hard worker and a really good, decent man. And he worked 55 hours a week in a cotton mill for 40 plus years.
Mm.
And I worked a summer there, and it was the most purgatorial work I've ever done. And then later, you know, I worked for the phone company. I was in the enlisted man in the army. I worked all the way through college. I drove taxi, worked in a hospital laundry. When I was in graduate school, I was a part-time janitor and gas pumper. I didn't get a middle-class job till I was 31, where I started as a reporter for the local newspaper. So I spent 15 years just doing working class jobs. That's the world that I came of age in, and that's why I write, I think, authentically about it.
Yeah, you do. You write very authentically about it. I have to say, it's interesting. Some of the characters for whom I did feel compassion. They began as being so truly hard for me to relate to, and I think it's just because perhaps your readers aren't all coming from the same place. But, for example, Ollie, you know, he is this friend of Howard's. He's like no one I've ever known. He lives very rough. He has a number of children, but two of them seem to be mentally disabled, and one of them runs away at one point, and when he finds him, Ollie beats him, and then hugs him, and then brings him home and dries him off and gets him dressed again and gives him soup, you know, and he's so hard to relate to, although I found that to be a truly touching, scene. How do your readers react to these characters?
Well, I'm afraid that writing about people like Ollie Jordan is not a ticket to the bestseller list. You know, and I knew that to begin with, but I said, "Hell, I'm going to do it anyway." And if you read the next book in the series is a little more than Kin, which is Ollie's story, and
right.
That's probably the most intense book I've ever written.
Okay.
But I think I know Ollie. I know that feeling in myself, and I grew up on a street in Keene, New Hampshire, that was a really poor neighborhood. In fact, when I was selling my dad's house after my mother died, my dad moved in with us, and I sold his house, and the real estate agent, Connie Joy, she said to me, I said, this house has been on the market for 6 months. We're lowering the price. She said, Ernie, this is the cheapest house in Keene. Nobody wants to live in this neighborhood, especially women.
Oh,
so that's the kind of neighborhood I grew up in. Those characters, the Jordans, actually were people that I grew up with as a kid.
Now, were they people who really would have discharged a gun in the house?
Well, I'll tell you, I had a gun. I had a number of guns, and I used to take my gun down, right down Main Street.
Oh, my gosh.
And walk into the Spencer's Hardware Store and buy bullets. Mm. I mean, those are the days you could do that.
Yeah.
And my friend John Westcott and I used to walk out right in back of our yard up in the Robin Hood Park and just fire away.
Yeah. Wow. How have local readers, like really local, true to the town that you're writing about, how have they reacted to the Darby Chronicles books through the years?
One of the best things about my writing career is that I've been embraced by local people, and I'm so grateful for that.
Mm.
Everybody thinks it's that I'm writing about somebody else. It's never that. I'll tell you a story.
Okay.
West Milan is kind of Darby is based geographically on West Milan. When my wife and I lived here, when we first got married, there was a particular lot we wanted, but we didn't have the money. It wasn't for sale. 35 years later, my wife found it for sale on the internet. We bought it. We built in 2009.
Hmm.
That summer, we lost our cat. But we eventually found it, but my wife put flyers in the mailboxes and got a call from Thelma, who was an old lady, and she said, Ernie, she said, I'm sorry about your cat, and I got a cat, and she talked about her cat, and then later she hung up, and I realized, you know, she was talking to me like we talk every day, and I hadn't talked to her in 38 years. So when we came back to West Milan, first of all, a lot of the people that we knew here from day one we're still here, and secondly they just treated us like we never left.
Nice.
It's a great feeling.
So are you getting a lot of responses of like, don't end the series? Are people, you know, talking
no,
to you about
really.
It? No.
I think people would like me to write something else.
Well, how about you? Are you going to miss writing this series, or do you have any second thoughts?
Well, what I'm doing now is I'm making a website called A Guide to the Darby Series, and I've written 51 essays, everything you want to know about Darby that's not in the books, and I've got some students who are helping me with the website, but the main thing I'm doing is I want to create the town visually. I do a lot of drawing, and I love to draw, especially on the computer. And I want to recreate this entire village, the architecture, the people, the forests, just everything, and make a visual statement with art that's going to go on this website.
That's wonderful.
That's I want to spend my last years.
Now, the picture of Cootie's Cabin that's on your website, did you do that?
Yes.
I love that. That's fantastic. But that doesn't look like a drawing. It almost looks like it's some sort of collage or something.
No. It's totally hand-drawn on
the
computer.
Oh, it's cool.
I used a program called SketchUp, which is a 3D program, to make the shapes and give it the depth, sense of depth. And then I colored it in Adobe Illustrator and then again in Photoshop. Right now I'm drawing on the iPad.
Oh, wow. That's great. So you just mentioned your website. Also on your website, you mentioned removing the middleman, which is the publisher, in publishing certain ebooks that you've written. The books that you were referring to are called Mad Boys and I Love You, the letter U, which are sort of futuristic alternative world novels. So I wondered if you can talk about those and then also talk about your publishing experience through the years and how you came to decide that you would put those out as ebooks.
Well, those books are kind of a different part of my sensibility. I've always, well, not lately, but when I was coming of age, I loved sci-fi, and I think if I was a young guy today, I probably would be some kind of a computer artist. I love computers, and I love science fiction, I had a big time agent for a while. He wanted me to write about a murder in New Hampshire to sell. Well, I didn't know about murders, so I bought a textbook that a police officer would use in school to learn how to investigate murders. Well, the book was full of photographs of murdered people.
Oh gosh!
And one was a photograph of a boy who had been strangled and left naked in this sexually suggestive position, and I thought, it kind of sent a shiver through me, and I thought, what if he got away? And then I said to myself, now what would happen if Huckleberry Finn was suddenly let loose in our world? That would be the 1990s I was thinking of. And then from there, the whole idea of Mad Boys just exploded in my head, and I typed out this crazy, crazy book. And then recently, I got interested in the singularity. Do you know what the singularity is?
No.
Singularity is the idea that eventually people will merge with computers.
Oh.
That you'll be able to take your identity, who you are, your memories, your self-awareness, and transfer it into a machine.
Ah.
And then that machine will look like you at your best age, whatever that happens to be, the age you want to be. And then you just replace parts. You'll live forever. that's the idea. And so I thought, well, so I wrote a sequel to Mad Boys based on the singularity idea.
And that's I Love You.
I love you. The you is a, this is about a dyslexic robot.
Okay. are you
dyslexic cyborg, let's put it that way.
Are you dyslexic or, I remember you said you couldn't get into college and that you didn't have high verbal scores, and Howard has a lot of trouble with reading, so now that makes me wonder.
Well, that's a very insightful of you to ask that question. I think I do have some kind of a hidden learning disability, which has never been diagnosed, because it wasn't until I was 21 that things all began to fall into place for me.
Hmm.
I could tell in high school that I was smart. I mean, I could reason well, but I could never quite, I was always behind other people in putting ideas together. So I feel that there's something missing there. And when I do type, I often leave words out, you know.
Yeah.
And I make a lot of typos. I was never a good speller. But like I said, I had the map of the big picture. I knew how to write compound complex sentences, but I might leave a word out. So there is something. I'm not firing in all cylinders, let's put it that way. But you know, in a way too, it's helped me become a writer because, you know, the handy cliches that most people have in their heads don't come immediately to mind to me. I have to sort of fabricate everything myself. So as a result, I think I'm very good with metaphors because I have to make everything up.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds about right. Having read this book, it seems that sounds about right. Your writing to me seemed very dreamlike, very much as though you let the writing guide you, which I think is sort of what you've already said. But do you find that that's true of your process?
Well, I do, and I'm kind of in awe at it. It's as if I'm a medium rather than I'm actually doing this work, and it kind of makes me understand where the biblical writers came from. You feel that your writing is coming from God or someplace like that, rather than from yourself.
That's a great feeling, isn't it?
It is a great feeling. It's the best reason to do it.
Yeah, and it's
you
and
that
it.
Experience?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it comes full circle. Although I'm not done with our interview yet, to the quote I mentioned from the beginning, what you said about writing fiction.
Yeah.
However, I'm not actually finished, so we can't come full circle. I wanted to ask you. I want to get back to something that was the second part of another question. Can you just talk a little bit about your experience with the publishing industry through the years? You decided to put out Mad Boys and I Love You as e-books, removing the middleman of the publisher. So, can we talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I hit the big time literary world quite fast and hard. I happen to have Mavis McIntosh, who was a really big time agent. She got my manuscript to big editors right away. I got a publisher right away. I got a citation from the Hemingway Foundation.
Wow.
I got bell ringer reviews and just everywhere, you know. This continued for about two books. I got good reviews and the books were not selling. They were selling in my backyard, but they were not selling nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got to Live Free or Die, which is the fifth novel of the Darby series, and which I thought was going to be the last novel, which got it was one of those books of the year by the New York Times, you know,
mm-hmm.
And it got a full page review in the New York Times Book Review.
Wow.
At the very same time that the publishing, that the Viking was sold to the Penguins, which was at the time was a British conglomerate, and they came in. My editor, I had a new editor at the time, had planned to put out all five books. You know,
mm-hmm.
Came in. They fired him. They fired everybody, and they looked at the sales. And they just dumped all the writers who just didn't have the sales thing. So I was out of New York publishing. And the advice I got, which is true, from an insider was, Ernie, once you're out for good. You're never going to get back in. So I had to, I was out of big time publishing. I didn't deserve to be there to begin with because I wasn't selling enough books. So I had to find a publisher, and eventually I found University Press of New England, where, by the way, my first editor was one of my former students.
Oh, wonderful.
I've actually had two books edited by former students. How's that for good luck?
That's great.
Isn't that awesome? Yeah, I wrote a book, a non-Darby book called Never Back Down, which is a semi-autobiographical book. My editor for that was Susan Barba, who was one of my students in Keene, and Keene's at Dartmouth, and then Michael Lowenthal, who's now a writer, published a number of books, was my editor for Mad Boys. University Press in New England. But you know, but eventually, you know, I wrote a thriller that I couldn't find a publisher for, and when I wrote I Love You, which is the sequel to Mad Boys, I couldn't find a publisher for it. So that's about the time that Amazon started to publish books. So I thought, well, what the hell? I don't need a publisher now. And so I thought, well, like electronic publishing is great for writers who can't find a publisher.
Yeah.
And even though I can find a publisher for some books I have, I can't find a publisher for all. I'll publish them myself. It's a lot more. It's a lot of fun. For one thing, I can design my own covers. I like designing covers.
When you make print covers for books, do you do print on demand for a few copies, even when you're only putting them out as e-books otherwise?
Oh no, I don't do print on demand. I just do e-books.
Just e-books. Okay.
Yeah, but I have designed covers for other people's books. I have a friend named Jack Hitchner, who's a poet and a novelist, and I designed his book cover.
Okay. You tell a story on your Dartmouth website about meeting John Gardner. He was gonna be your workshop consultant or whatever at Breadloaf. Can you tell that story, because it's a great story? And then it ends with some really good advice for writers if you can include your three rules. I don't know if you.
I reached a point when I was a newspaper reporter that my creative writing just wasn't going anywhere.
Right.
And my wife, God bless her, dragged me kicking and screaming to the Breadloaf Writers Conference, where my mentor was going to be John Gardner, who was a writer I admired greatly. I can remember thinking about all these people were having fun. You know, they were playing tennis and just having a great time, and I just hated them all because I was so miserable, and, you know. And I can remember going into Gardner's office. He had my manuscript, about 60 pages. And I knew it instantly wasn't going to go well, because he didn't make eye contact with me. He looked at the page and he said, he dragged his finger about a third of the way down the page. He said, "This is as far as I read." He said, "No real writer would write a sentence like this." And, you know, I was so devastated by that. Well, devastated is not the right word. It was as if I had the wind knocked out of me. I couldn't speak.
Yeah.
I could hardly breathe, and I just kind of staggered out of the office. And I spent a day in a kind of daze. But on the drive back home, I began to realize that, you know, he was right. That I was not writing well, and the best writing I had done had been done over and over. It hadn't been done just one time, kind of one draft writing. I got in this bad habit of one draft writing from being a newspaper reporter. We have to knock stuff out.
Right.
So I made some rules for myself, which was that I would not leave a page until it was perfect. This was on the typewriter now.
Okay.
I put a page in the typewriter, type the page out, pencil edit it, and retype it. I would not leave a page until it was perfect. And then every page had to have something in it that I hadn't seen before, an original metaphor, some kind of action that I thought was unique. And I can't remember my third rule.
you wrote on your website, follow the protagonist's inner life with the same care and intensity as his outer life.
That's right, yeah.
Right,
That was it, because I was writing about a working class guy, and I had this chip on my shoulder that I told you about earlier. So I followed, you know, the idea was that, to me, the domain of a novelist is the interior life of the characters. That's something that we novelists do better than movies or stage plays or poets.
Yeah.
And so my idea was, I am going to follow the inner life of the character with the same care as I follow his outer life.
Yeah. Yeah, I loved those rules. I thought that would be a good place for us to finish our conversation because it's really good advice for writers. I want to thank you very much, Ernest Hebert. The book was The Dogs of March, and the series was The Darby Chronicles, published by University Press of New England. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Well, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Ernest Hebert. You can learn more about his work at his website, erniehebert.com, erniehebert.com. When you go there, keep in mind that the amazing artwork on the site was created by Ernie in the manner that he described earlier. It's really very creative and beautiful. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule. Custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crow's Trading Post on Facebook for more information. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Ernest Hebert. He tells his students to take a page and draw a line down the middle. On one side, write something that you like about yourself. For example, if you're loyal to friends. On the other side, write something that you don't like very much about yourself. For example, if you have a petty streak. Keep going. Fill both sides of the page. You don't have to show anyone else. Just keep it for yourself. Ernie says that in that language, you will find all of the characters you will ever need for a career in writing. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And there's also information there about my book, Shape of the Sky. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.